Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This is C-SPAN's Afterwards podcast. This week, former Congresswoman, longtime national security insider, and former Wilson Center President Jane Harman on how the U.S. has failed to confront some of its most challenging national security issues. Her book is called Insanity Defense, Why Our Failure to Confront Hard National Security Problems Make Us Less Safe. She's interviewed by former Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano.
Representative Harman, good to see you. I enjoyed your book. You entitled it Insanity Defense. Why title it that way?
Well, I will explain after I say a couple things about my interrogatory or whatever you are, my friend. Just to point out that there are some very long friendships in politics and policy. And I was thinking about it that in the 70s, mid-70s perhaps, when each of us was five, Janet Napolitano was an associate in a law firm. The principal's name was John Frank, and my name was Jane Frank at the time. And I met her. She was smart as a whip, no surprise. And has gone through all the big political jobs in Arizona and then came to Washington to become Secretary of Homeland Security when I was in Congress on the Homeland Security Committee. So we overlapped there and then had the wisdom to go to Paradise, California, where I am still a resident. And I knew her in her last incarnation at the, running the University of California system. And I'm thrilled now that she's at Berkeley, which is headed by a wonderful Chancellor, Carol Crist, also a good friend. So just wanted to say that not only can I remember this, but kudos, my friend, you have had a spectacular career so far. So how in the world did I name this book Insanity Defense? The name is getting so much attention. Well, it wasn't my idea. I actually had a very boring title in mind that's relevant to the topic. And I was talking to my fourth child, a daughter, who's a writer. And I said, so I'm writing this book, and here's what it's about, and this is the title. Mother, that's so boring. The right title is Insanity Defense. And I mean, just out of her mouth. And she said, that will excite the audience. That tells what you're talking about. And I said, sold. You know, it's a wrap. And what it means, I'm sure we all know, everyone listening in and watching, is that doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result is the definition of insanity. And that's what I talk about over three decades.
Right. And your book is a kind of a fascinating exposition of particularly your time in Congress. But why don't you share with our viewers how you came to be a member of Congress? Give them a little bit of the story of Jane Harman.
Will do. So I grew up in Los Angeles, I am still a Californian, public school kid, and with my then boyfriend, whom I'm actually still in touch with, who also moved to Washington, I went to the Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles in 1960. You know, believe me, I was minus 10 years old. We both were. And we got on the floor of the convention. There was not, massive security back in the day. And I saw the nomination of John Kennedy, and I met Eleanor Roosevelt and some of the other luminaries. And I, at that moment, had my life epiphany, which is that I love politics. And I was an usher at the Los Angeles Coliseum where Kennedy gave his acceptance speech. I got active in politics in high school. I co-ran my Democratic club in college. and, you know, was just hooked. I went to law school because I thought that my unscientific survey showed me that at least a third of people serving in Congress are lawyers. I think it's probably higher. And that was what I was interested in. And then I practiced law briefly, lived abroad briefly, but migrated to the Senate, where I was a senior aide to a California senator named John Tunney. I think that's when I got involved with John Frank, because I headed a subcommittee working on access to the law, access to lawyers. And he was then, I think, either the head of or a senior member of the American Bar Association. But at any rate, worked for John Tunney for 5 years, at a time when there were almost no women in roles like that. I was chief counsel to the Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights, worked in the Carter White House for 2 years as the deputy cabinet secretary, and then was a practicing lawyer and so forth during the dark years of the Reagan administration, which, looking back on them, were not so dark. I can see many things he did right. And then found the opportunity to run for Congress where I had grown up. And it was kind of daunting because the district lines were changed in 1992. There's a redrawing of congressional lines every 10 years based on the census. And what I thought was a safe Democratic seat became a lean Republican seat. But that means Republicans are more likely to win, very almost even registration. And I won against the odds. One of my opponents was Maureen Reagan, daughter of Ronald Reagan, who was then retired and was helping her win. However, the California Democratic Party elected someone else to be my opponent. And that other person was far more conservative and not pro-choice. Maureen Reagan was pro-choice. And that was the searing issue of that year, 1992. Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas, for anyone who remembers that.
And, the year of the woman.
Yeah, it was the year of the woman. And women doubled the number of seats in Congress. Two women were elected from my state as senators, Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer. And Feinstein is still serving. And there I was. And it was a great ride until I really was gagging on the partisanship. And that was why I left, I'm sure you're going to ask me this, in 2011 to succeed Lee Hamilton, a wonderful mentor and friend, as the president, first woman president of the Wilson Center, a very well-known think tank in Washington. And I just left that after 10 years. And I'm now president emerita and planning my next career.
And you're now an author too.
Now I'm an author. And oh, by the way, the quarantine was horrible for everybody, far worse for others than for me and my family. But the one upside for me was I spent a huge amount of time in my house. I was running the Wilson Center, but I also wrote the book that I had been planning to write for years. And I finally had enough time to write it.
Right. So there's a lot in the book about 9/11 and its aftermath. One of the results of the attack of 9/11 was the decision to create a new Department of Homeland Security. Can you share a little bit the thinking behind that? And has the department met your expectations?
Well, I already said, and I think you might be familiar, Madam Secretary, that you were one of the occupants running that department over the years. But there is a backstory, and I do tell it in the book. The government was not prepared for 9/11. I think every single vertical human knows that, in spite of warnings by several commissions. I actually served on one, and acts of terrorism against the U.S. and the first World Trade Center bombing and the blowing up of two of our embassies in Africa. In spite of that, our government was not prepared, basically caught flat-footed. It was one of two major intelligence failures within a short period. The other one was the totally wrong estimate of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which caused us to invade Iraq, and then there were no weapons of mass destruction. But at any rate, after 9/11, the good news, it was horrible news, but the good news it was that the country reacted as a country. America reacted. It wasn't, gee, it's your fault. No, it's her fault. And both political parties voted together on strategies to make America safer and better. And one of the things we did early was to authorize the use of military force in Afghanistan against those who attacked us. I'm sure we'll talk about this later. But we, many of us, and I had, you know, fairly senior position on the Intelligence Committee. And in 2004, the Homeland Security Committee was formed, and I became a member of that as well, and ultimately chaired its intelligence subcommittee. But at any rate, we did think that there ought to be a Homeland Security, dedicated Homeland Security function in the White House. And President Bush, 43, created one. And Tom Ridge, former governor of Pennsylvania, was in the post. And I tell some funny stories about that. But at any rate, we, the hearty little group on Capitol Hill, bipartisan, thought that position should have more power to direct a homeland response across the government. We were not plotting to create a new department. But what happened was that there were just increasing clues, it was clear that there were missed clues on 9/11. That's what it was. And one of them was that an FBI agent in the Midwest had noticed, this is before 9/11, that some folks were taking flight instruction,
pilot training.
Yes, that's what they were doing. But they weren't interested in taking off and landing. They were only interested in how do you fly the plane, which obviously caught the attention of the instructors at the school. It was reported to the FBI, and this woman named Colleen Rowley wrote a report about this, sent to FBI Central, which got very little attention until it was about to leak and get major attention in the newspapers. I think the New York Times, I'm not positive. But at any rate, the Rowley memo was about to hit the front page when, out of nowhere, it seemed, Andy Card, who was chief of staff at the time to President Bush, 43, basically announced that they supported a new Department of Homeland Security and that 88 departments and agencies would be put under one banner and functions combined to protect the homeland. And of course, this announcement knocked the Rowley memo off the front page. And there it was. I mean, President Bush, 43, supported a new department. So there we were on Capitol Hill saying, oh, my goodness, how did this happen? And what do we do? And we decided that although we had been in favor of a smaller function in the White House, this was going to get legs because the president supported it. And we were better off supporting it rather than opposing it because we did want a stronger homeland function. And over time, that became this new department, which was a gigantic reorganization of government. And there were some kinks along the way and still are. But I would say now, I don't know if it's quite two decades yet, but close enough to two decades in, the place is sorting out and it can do a lot of things that are very useful for the government, and people have gotten used to the reorganization. And a huge, I'm sure you'll ask me about this, we have, you know, huge issues with immigration on the border. We have huge issues with cyber. We have huge issues with domestic terrorism. And all of those basically fit under the umbrella of the Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah, the Department of Homeland Security is a behemoth. And, you know, it's the largest reorganization of the federal government since the creation of the Department of Defense. In the aftermath of World War II. So, I will acknowledge it's had some pains along the way. Doing any kind of reorg like that is challenging. I also would agree that the department now, I'm going to exclude the Trump years, but the department now is very much evolved since its initial initial days. You know, one thing that hasn't evolved about it is the issue of congressional oversight. You mentioned that there are, and you mentioned in the book, there are 88 committees and subcommittees of the Congress that exercise some sort of jurisdiction over the Department of Homeland Security. Do you think there's any realistic way for that to be reformed? That was one of the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission, and it's the one that hasn't had any action yet. So
that is right. Well, I misspoke because I said the department was 88 functions. It was 22 functions, only 22, only the largest reorg in history other than the Pentagon, right?
Right.
That. But Congress does, or did last time I checked, have 88 committees and subcommittees with some piece of jurisdiction over the Homeland Security enterprise, which is absurd. And I remember less in your case, but when Michael Chertoff, who was another of the secretaries of Homeland Security, he was a Bush appointee, another excellent secretary, had to testify all over the place all the time. So you are correct that the 9/11 Commission, which was created a bipartisan commission co-chaired by Lee Hamilton, again, my predecessor at the Wilson Center, and Tom Kane, a former governor of New Jersey, recommended that Congress reorganize. And, you know, my answer to that is forget about it. Congress has a 19th century structure. I mean, it has an agriculture committee. Think about that. I'm not diminishing the fact that ag is a major industry in some states in the country. But I think when you think about it, to devote all those resources to ag, I don't know what percentage of the U.S. GDP it is, and so many fewer resources to Homeland Security makes no sense. I was on the committee for 8 years, and the frustration was that very often we wanted to do something, and we discovered that we didn't have jurisdiction to do it. The jurisdiction was actually in some other committee. And the chairman of the committee, who was and still is Benny Thompson of Mississippi, used to ask for more jurisdiction. And we'll consider it. We'll consider it. And don't hold your breath. But it is the largest, you are correct, the largest unfulfilled suggestion of the 9/11 Commission. And I predict it will be unfulfilled for a while longer.
Sad, but true. You know, another impact of 9/11, and you've already mentioned this, was the decision to invade Iraq, which you supported at the time. But it was based on serious mistakes in the intelligence. Given all of the intelligence agencies, et cetera, throughout the federal government, what is your analysis of how we got the intel so wrong?
Well, back then, let's understand, you mentioned the 1947 National Security Act that created the Defense Department structure. It also created our intelligence structure. And what it created was a couple of little old agencies, one of which is called the CIA, which had some management functions over a community, the intelligence community. It was called Community Management Service, run by the CIA. So things went along over the years, and the CIA was very much challenged in the technology department. It basically was a human spy agency for years. And when I was elected to Congress in 1992, which was the first post-Cold War class in the year of the woman, I got very interested in all this because my congressional district in Southern California, most of our intelligence satellites. So we were building up our technology. But again, we had a bunch of silos. We had human intelligence. Then we had SIGINT. SIGINT is what we can listen to mostly from satellites. And there were a lot of other INTs, each one in a silo. And then we had the FBI in a different place, which mostly focused on domestic intelligence. So, as I have said often, my breathless soundbite is, no business in the world could operate under a 1947 business model now. And this was just too two decades ago, but that's still true. So leading up to the Iraq war, that's what you asked me, after the major intelligence failure on 9/11, we had a bunch of talented, you know, serious folks who didn't talk to each other, who didn't connect the dots. And we also had in Dick Cheney, then the vice president, and a few others, some ideologues in government at the time who believed a theory, I guess you'd call it the sort of freedom theory, that if we could knock off Saddam Hussein, whom they thought was a bad guy — I don't think anyone wants to defend him, certainly I don't — but if we could knock him off, we could change Iraq into a democracy. And that idea would have the domino effect of changing many other governments into democracies. And so when they were called neocons, neoconservatives. So there were two things going on before the Iraq National Intelligence Estimate, the NIE, that was fatally flawed. One was the neocons had a theory of change that they wanted to support with an intelligence argument. The other was the intelligence community wasn't a community and it was disaggregated. So we ended up with a cherry-picked, sloppily assembled case for invading Iraq. And shame on me, that's in the book. I read everything. I read the supporting evidence they had. I read the intelligence estimate carefully. I traveled to the United Kingdom or Britain, which had still has some extremely competent intelligence agencies. They also bought the case. And I traveled to the Middle East. And I came home, and this is in the book, and I told my late husband, Sidney Harmon, that I read everything. I'm going to vote for the Iraq war because I believed that Iraq — I didn't believe the neocon theory of democracy, but I did believe that the intelligence showed that America was at risk and possibly it could be attacked, especially by the chemical and biological weapons that Saddam Hussein had, and that he was also building nuclear capacity. At any rate, I come home and I tell my late husband, who was a vaunted businessman, and I'm voting for the Iraq war. And he gives — this is in the book — he gives me the look, you know, rolling his eyes. "You're going to do what?" And I said, "Read everything. You don't know anything about this. You run a major successful business, but you haven't done the homework." And he just rolled his eyes again. And he said, "It's a lot of crap and you'll see." And guess what? Turns out he was a better intelligence analyst or intelligence oversight person than I. And when we learned later that one of the key sources, a German guy, had never been vetted by us, and the Germans told us that he was unreliable. And when we learned also that the State Department intelligence function called INR did not believe the case in the NIE, it was embarrassing. And all that led to one of the successful things I did. You know, I made a lot of mistakes, which was to join a small group which accomplished one of the other recommendations of the 9/11 Commission, which was to establish a coordinating function across the intelligence community called the Office of the Director of National Intelligence.
And I was just going to go there. And the story of the creation of the ODNI, or DNI, Director of National Intelligence, is really a signature accomplishment of your time in the Congress. I'm not sure that it could be created in today's world in the Congress, but maybe you could share with the viewers some of the ins and outs of what you went through to bring that legislation over the goal line.
Well, let's understand, it finally passed in 2004, which is centuries ago in political time. And that was a time when the parties talked to each other, and it was a much more functional place. Congress actually thought about enacting laws to solve problems and put the country first. I know some people watching this might think I'm delusional that I lived through this period, but I did. And probably all of you did too, or most of you. But at any rate, setting up this joint command function was a recommendation of the 9/11 Commission. It also was a recommendation of something called the Joint Inquiry on 9/11. What in the world was that? That was not a group. It was both intelligence committees, House and Senate, which met together, try this, Democrats and Republicans, all together, bipartisan, bicameral. I know people are probably wondering if I'm taking my meds today, in the dome of the Capitol. The intelligence rooms used to be in the Capitol dome, which many think was the intended target of the fourth airplane on 9/11, which went down in a field in Pennsylvania due to the heroism of passengers. But anyway, we met there, and one of the cute stories is there's a big dais hearing room, but all of us piling in there were too many, so they had to set up little card tables below the dais and cover them with paper cloths like a kiddie party. And I would call them the kiddie tables. And I sat at one. And a lot of friendships were formed then. Dan Coats, I think, was at my kiddie table. Dan Coats, to remind, Republican, we got along fine. Later became ambassador to Germany and then ultimately the DNI until he was unceremoniously pushed out by President Trump. And this is a conservative Republican who came back to serve because his president asked. Anyway, that was a recommendation of the 9/11, the joint inquiry too. So I and others introduced legislation to create this new function. It was pretty quickly done in the House, even though there was some strong opposition by some Republicans, one of whom was Vice President Cheney, surprise, and another of whom was Duncan Hunter, the father, who then chaired the House Armed Services Committee. But my chairman, I was ranking member, Pete Hoekstra, a Republican from Michigan, and I stayed close and we're tough, and he was very brave to do it. And we ultimately got the bill passed by the House, and then it was an even harder slog in the Senate, where Susan Collins, who still serves, she's the sole Republican member in the Northeast, try that. But where Susan Collins, I think, chaired at the time the Senate Homeland Committee, and Joe Lieberman, who was first a Democrat and then an independent, was her ranking member. So it was Lieberman, Collins, Harmon, and Hoekstra, and we were the so-called Big Four working out the differences in the bills, and it was hard, and we did it. We met late at night in the office of Speaker Dennis Hastert of the House, Republican Speaker Hastert. And of course, I tell the story that we got along so well because we drank all his wine, which we probably did. There's another cute story about Susan and Jane going out after one of these meetings to have a nightcap at a hotel near the Hill.
Now, Bistro Bis, you say.
Bistro Bis. Well, yeah. I don't know that everybody knows where Bistro Bis is. Well, C-SPAN folks would, because it's near C-SPAN. And some guy sends over two glasses of wine. And I thought, what is this? So I asked the waiter, who is this person? And all it was a guy seeing us chatting so closely together and saying, how nice, they must be sisters. I would just like to celebrate that. And that's what happened. So, I mean, it was hard, and we got it done. It took a while, like everything else, to get its sea legs. But I think right now, under its first woman director, Avril Haines, it is doing the job we intend.
And talk a little bit about your relationship with Senator Collins. I found that one of the really nice insights in the book, but maybe you could just say a few words.
So there are now a lot of women in the House and Senate. Back in my day, or initially in my day, there were about 30 in the House, and I'm not sure how many in the Senate, 30 out of 435. That's not a huge percentage, but now there are over 100. And in the Senate, I think it's 25% female, or maybe more, actually. But at any rate, what happened and still happens, is the women get along by and large. And there are women's caucuses in each house, and they're very productive. And I think there are monthly lunches or monthly dinners in the Senate. I'm not sure what happens in the House. Maybe too big to make. And the House has gone through a, it seems to me, a steep decline in terms of comity and civility. So I don't know if it still meets, but I think it does in the Senate. And Susan and I became friends through another senator. You would know, Arizona Senator John Kyle, who thought we would like each other. Kyle's a Republican, conservative, but he and I worked closely together on defense issues, and I knew him pretty well. And he said, I want to introduce you to my colleague, Susan. And then we were paired on this DNI project, and it just clicked. And I say in the book that Harry Truman was wrong. He said that if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog. I'm not saying that's wrong, but I think, at least in my life, my dog died, so I don't have a dog friend. In my life, if you want a friend in Washington, get a girlfriend. And I describe carefully the relationships I've had with women mentors, even before I served. My principal woman mentor before I served was Geraldine Ferraro, whom I was extremely close to. But Susan and I, the friendship endures, and doesn't mean we agree on everything. In fact, we specifically disagreed on a couple of big ones in the last few years, but the friendship endures. When she got engaged, I went crazy. Among other things, hosted her big engagement party at my home. And that was a big bipartisan gathering. I don't know if that could happen anymore. And she tried on her wedding dresses in my house. And when she got married in Caribou, Maine, if you think that's an actual place on a map, you're wrong. It's like Brigadoon. It comes out of the mist, and there it is for 10 minutes. And getting there was horrific. It was a family gathering. I was in a very small group. And I finally arrived after planes, trains, and automobiles 9 hours later, just in time for her rehearsal dinner. And there's Susan standing outside in the rain. Of course, it would be raining, with a drink in hand for me. Good call. But she said, shouldn't have come. It was way too hard for you. And I said, Susan, I would have walked. It's that good a friendship, and it means a lot to me, and I think it means a lot to her. And I value that so much, and it made serving there so much better. And it maybe it still makes her service there. I mean, it's not easy being there better because we still have each other.
Yeah. One of your chapters is entitled The Fog of Law, and which I thought was a wonderful chapter title. But now I'm hearkening back to your days, not only as a member of Congress, but as a very, very good lawyer. Maybe you could describe for the viewers what you mean by the fog of law. This also is an aftermath of the invasion of Iraq, but
very much. Okay. Yes, it's also it also relates to our staying in Afghanistan after we accomplished the immediate mission authorized by Congress and ended up with a lot of hard problems. The book covers many of them. And there was a fog of law, meaning the law wasn't clear on what we should be doing. The fog of law, the term, is adapted from the fog of war. Many have known for years that it is very unclear going into a battle or even into a war how it's going to come out. And one of the questions I now ask myself about everything in life is one that retired General Dave Petraeus always asks. And so he's become a very good friend. He was involved in Afghanistan, Iraq. He ran Central Command. He was CIA director in my time. So I know him well, but his question is, how will this end? And we didn't ask that question enough. And so the fog of law was the title of a speech I gave at Georgetown Law School about a year after the Iraq, or no, maybe it was, I'm not exactly sure when it was, but I sort of toted up all the things we are doing, were doing, some of which we are still doing because it's too hard to answer hard questions, and said that it's very unclear, especially to folks who have to be the actors carrying out these programs, what they're supposed to do. And we don't have a legal framework around the whole thing. We have a patchwork. And it turned out, for example, in the first term of Bush 43, that a lot of what we were doing in the surveillance area was not in compliance. I didn't know this at the time, but I explained it. Was not in compliance with the law that relates to it called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Why wasn't it? It wasn't because Vice President Cheney and others assumed that Congress would not do a good job and maybe should even be cut out of amending FISA, that's the acronym, to cover these things. So what did they do? They went to the Justice Department and got the Office of Legal Counsel, in other words, the in-house lawyer for the Justice Department, to write some opinions justifying what they were doing. And so when I asked the question, is what you're doing in full compliance with the law? The answer always was yes, but it wasn't in full compliance with the law Congress passed. It was in full compliance with some legal opinions by the Justice Department. And one that many people have heard of are some legal opinions written by a guy named John Yoo, Y-O-O, who's now a tenured professor at Berkeley Law School. And they had to do with the definition of torture and some other things directly relevant to how we interrogated those we detained in connection with Afghanistan and Iraq. And Yu's definition was that torture is bodily harm. No, is imminent death.
Or serious organ failures.
Serious organ failure or imminent death.
Yeah.
And that's his definition of torture, which does not comply with the definition in U.S. law. It does not comply with the definition in the Geneva Conventions, which is the international agreement that we struck after World War II. So you just was freelancing, and Cheney and crowd wanted that to be the definition. And you was actually afterwards questioned on his legal reasoning. And the guy who questioned him, Jack Goldsmith, was then the head of OLC, the Office of Legal Counsel. And Goldsmith got pushed out for doing that.
Yeah, yeah. The fog of law refers to surveillance. It refers to how we treat detainees and it also concerns what we do about Guantanamo and Gitmo, as we refer to it often. And you describe in the book some of the legal issues with respect to how we treat detainees and how we adjudicate whether they have actually committed the acts for which they are being detained. But closing Gitmo, it turns out, is once you've started putting people there, it's very difficult. So maybe let me ask you this question. There are still inmates being held at Gitmo. What would you advise President Biden to do about that?
So, again, one of my mistakes, which I describe in the book, was going to Gitmo for the first time. When we hastily set it up, we didn't have actual prison facilities built. So what did we do? We used basically chicken wire to create different cells. And just imagine this, these guys taken off the battlefield or in other places wearing orange jumpsuits and in these chicken wire, some called them cages. By the way, the whole prison system of communicating was worked out then. And you know, we anticipated almost nothing. But so I go to Gitmo with a group of congressional members. We're in the launch between the airfield and the actual prison. You have to go over water. And I asked the Army three-star, why is this prison here? And he says, to be beyond the reach of U.S. law. Now, Janet, you are a, talk about a skilled lawyer. You knew, and I actually knew too. I went to a, I'm sorry, I didn't go to what was then called Bowles Hall, but I went to Harvard Law School. And I knew that you couldn't build a prison that way and have it run by Americans bringing folks there that we had apprehended. And I knew that was not constitutional. It took the Supreme Court some years to come to that conclusion, but that's the conclusion. So now the folks who were there are entitled to lawyers and U.S. process. But at any rate, I didn't say anything. Why didn't I say anything? Because I thought, maybe there's something I don't understand. It's soon after 9/11. I'd be putting the country in danger. But we made a huge mistake to set it up there. We brought people there who had been treated, who had suffered the torture that didn't meet John Yoo's definition. So in many cases, or in some cases, these folks were waterboarded. We later learned that was one of the techniques, and we can talk about that too, because I was briefed on that after it was used, while it was used. And other things that would not comply with the U.S. definition of torture. And so in legal jargon, the evidence against them, to the extent it was gotten, is tainted because the improper means were used to get it. So these people go to Guantanamo Bay. Originally, there were hundreds. Now we're down to 40 high-value targets, we call them. And one of them, the mastermind of 9/11, a guy named Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, was waterboarded numerous times. And what do? We keep them there. I mean, they can't be tried, basically. They have lawyers. We keep talking about military commissions. They always get postponed. My proposal, and I included this in a recent op-ed, is that Congress, let's see if this is doable, enact a doctrine which we've never had in this country called of preventive detention. So at least they have a status. And in that status, their situations are reviewed on a periodic basis. They really can't be tried, but they certainly could be treated in a more formal way. And I would argue that Gitmo should be closed and they should be moved to the United States. And I don't buy it that this would be a huge danger to our communities, because we actually did try and convict 400 people after 9/11, or even after the first attack on the
World Trade Center,
of terrorism-related crimes. And they're in supermax prisons, very austere, very well-guarded places, and there is no evidence that any of them has escaped. So we're talking about 40 folks who could be put in this preventive detention program and moved to a supermax prison someplace. And then we would close Gitmo, which is a stain, I think, just a stain on the U.S. rule of law, and also a recruiting tool for the bad guys who say, look, this is how these people treat. This is how the United States treats people. This is why they are, their culture is corrupted, and we are right to attack them.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned this a bit earlier. You touched upon it a little bit earlier, but the administration at that time supported something called the unitary theory of the executive. One of its big proponents is David Addington, who I went to public high school with in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So, it's interesting how things. Really what the unitary theory of the executive is that anytime the president is acting in any kind of international capacity, he has sole authority, and Congress is just kind of a bit player. And that's kind of a tension that runs through the book, the tension between the executive branch and the legislative branch. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. And I got to know Addington in his role as Cheney's lawyer. And I had a couple of encounters, and I described one of them, which was extremely amusing. And he's a courtly, bright man. So I guess that's because he went to high school with you, Janet. That's right. But anyway, so...
He was the best man at my brother's wedding.
my. Okay. So the Constitution sets up three branches of government. The legislative branch under Article 1, the executive branch under Article 2, and the courts, Article 3. The legislative branch, to remind, Article 1 passes the laws and funds the government. The executive branch, supposedly, carries out the laws and is subject to review by the legislative branch to make sure that the administration, that the handling of matters under the law is done properly. And then the federal courts decide if the laws passed by Congress pass muster under the Constitution. That's how it's supposed to work. The separation of powers has been a really good concept over our 230 plus years of existence and worked pretty well. And Congress was, I think, enormously skilled at foreign policy over the years until it wasn't, until it started this slippery slope to political and toxic partisanship. But at any rate, the Cheney-Addington theory of the unitary executive means that we will do what we think is right. The president is the commander in chief. That is true, and designated that in Article 2. And if and when we feel like it, we will let Congress know what we're doing, and we will justify basically what we're doing by a series of legal opinions issued by the Justice Department. We just talked about this. These OLC opinions. And certainly after 9/11, country under threat, the president needs to exercise these commander-in-chief functions. So it was really hard in Congress, in a senior role on an oversight committee, to get information. And I got some, but I mentioned already that I kept asking if our actions fully comply with law. And answered yes, but the law they were talking about was the OLC opinion, not the law Congress passed. And I think there still is executive overreach. The book has, the two last chapters are about the powerful executive, and then the last chapter is the incredible shrinking Congress. Now, I think this is unhealthy, and this is not a rant for Democrats to take over everything. It's a rant for parties that are people who are serious and elected to public office in the Congress. Put country over party and try to solve some hard problems, which they have been ducking.
Right. And you've mentioned several times the hyper-partisanship in Congress today. What's your analysis about how that has happened and what risks that poses to the American people?
Well, there may be, it turns out that there were kind of raucous times during the founding of our country, and the Federalist Papers and other documents weren't enacted without a lot of noise and fracturing. But what I'm saying is, over time, our institutions function better. I'm not trying to put anything under the rug. Until at least in my lifetime, the late 80s, when something called the negative ad was invented by a campaign consultant named Lee Atwater. And it turns out, since I ran for Congress so many times, I know this, that negative ads have much more, and you would know this too, penetrate much faster than positive ads. People just glom onto negative information, and this has been perfected. So that was one of the tools that kind of fractured the comity between Democrats and Republicans. And then it also happened that I think the Supreme Court nomination of Bork for the Supreme Court in the late 80s was the first time the Democratic Party also engaged in some of this. And I think Ted Kennedy, deceased, a great senator, would may not agree with me. And Joe Biden, who was then chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee running the hearing, may not agree with me. But it was an extremely contentious and ugly hearing. And it ended in Bork not being confirmed. And so the 90s were the beginning of the slippery slope to where we are. And lucky me, I came to Congress in the 90s. And I saw a lot of this up close and personal. And Newt Gingrich was in the book, and whom I now get along with. I actually just did in a conversation with him about the book on his blog. But Newt's theory of the case was, we just got the majority. This was the Republicans in 1994. And to hold the majority, we have to be partisan. He admits that. And that was, very unhelpful. I mean, he said to me, as we were talking about his blog, the blog, or maybe before, he said, we certainly looked at you, but we figured we couldn't take you out. So, I mean, is this because they wanted to take me out because I wasn't responsible? I wasn't bipartisan. I wasn't helpful. No, they wanted to take me out because I was one of the members of the Democratic team, and they wanted to be in the majority. So that attitude of take out the other side, because if you work with them, you don't get enough power and you don't get reelected, is where we sadly are today.
Do you think that Congress, as currently configured, is up to the task of national security and all of the oversight function, et cetera, that needs to be done there?
I think that some members of Congress are up to the task. George Will, who no one would accuse of being a card-carrying liberal, just wrote a glowing op-ed about Jack Reed. Jack Reed is a Democrat from Rhode Island who chairs the Senate Armed Services Committee and has for a long time. He's a former veteran. He's a Harvard Law School graduate. Let's not hold that against him. He has a master's degree from the Kennedy School, and he knows a boatload about national defense. He's not the only one. But I'm saying, and Will was all about how we really have to refocus how we spend money on defense, which I completely agree with. And Reed is trying to do that. It's very hard to reorganize stuff. You and I can tell all our war stories. But my point is, there are really good members of Congress like him. There certainly was Sam Nunn. There was Dick Lugar. They were extraordinary members of Congress. There was John McCain. So members of Congress are up to it. Some of them serve on the relevant committees. Most people try to get on committees that reflect their district, as I did, or certainly that reflect their expertise. If Congress functioned better, if something called the regular order were observed, the regular order means that committees mark up bills and report them to the floor, and deference is made to what committees do before laws are passed. If all that happened, Congress might have the expertise it needs, and it might attract better people who have the expertise they would share. But it's a meat grinder now. You run for Congress in some of these districts, and you have very shrill people on either end, both the left and the right, opposing you if you're anywhere in the center and want to solve problems. Bipartisanship is a dirty word, and it's tragic. And so who loses? You ask me that. We lose, the whole country, and the members lose. I mean, it's not easy to get elected to Congress. You don't fall out of bed and get elected to Congress or attorney general of a state or governor of a state or whatever. Doesn't happen like that. So you work your tail off to get elected. Presumably, one of the motivations you have is to make the country better. Then you get into an institution where you really can't do that because you're on one side and they're on the other side. And the efforts to work together are basically, and it's not every time, but basically discounted and politically dangerous.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. We're coming almost to the end of our time together. Let me just ask you if you could give a few closing reflections on what you think are the major risks facing the country today as opposed to when you came to Congress?
Well, Well, let's start with where we just ended, toxic partisanship. As we speak today, we're watching a couple of things, or in the last weeks, we're watching a couple of things happen in the Republican caucus in the House. Liz Cheney, the daughter of Dick Cheney, who bravely spoke her truth, was pushed out of leadership on the Republican side. And a lot of jokes were made about her and her father. And, you know, finally, regime change happened to a Cheney and all this silliness. But she's a serious member of Congress. And whether you agree with her or not, I think the way this was handled was, you know, very unfortunate. And then today, this whole effort about forming a 1-6 commission, modeled after the 9/11 commission, has sadly, so far as I know, resulted in a partisan vote. That doesn't mean it won't move through Congress. But the 9/11 vote was strongly bipartisan. And the respect for the leaders of the 9/11 commission, Lee Hamilton and Tom Kaine, was strong across the country. And the respect for their conclusions was strong. And shouldn't we know? I mean, that the first serious insurrection against our country has been thoroughly investigated on a nonpartisan or bipartisan basis. We find out what really happened, and then serious recommendations to prevent it from happening again are considered by a Congress that wants to protect the country. That's what we should want. And neither of those things is happening. So I think toxic partisanship is the top of my list. I think, you know, the breakdown of community and institutions is there too, because our country doesn't work properly. And people are in their silos listening to their echo chamber fueled by social media. I think this is hugely dangerous. Then I would say, certainly focusing on the U.S., some things that the Biden administration has identified are the right things that are big dangers for our country. One is the pandemic. We've all suffered. And there is progress in the U.S., but there needs to be progress in the world in order to prevent this from coming back. And the human tragedy still here, but especially in other countries, is gigantic. And if Biden wants a new foreign policy, I think, you know, doing outreach to help the entire world get the medicines that were invented here, delivered by the logistics that we do better than anyone else, is our best move. So pandemic, climate, no one can miss it. Coming from California, and there you are, coming from California, it's a tinderbox, and there's a drought across the entire state. Third issue is domestic terrorism. And that, again, is fueled by isolation and by the toxic politics we have. So those are three. Sure, China has risen. We missed that in some ways. But we, I think, can compete and cooperate with China. We actually are making a move that I just saw in today's news with Russia, which is engaged in extremely bad behavior. And we have sanctioned them for some of their cyber efforts. But Secretary of State Blinken is meeting with Secretary of State Lavrov in the Arctic, which is a place where we actually cooperate, sort of, with Russia. And the Biden administration just waived the sanctions on the head of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. This is fascinating. That is a Russian pipeline skirting Ukraine going to Germany. And it's been a very contentious thing because it's Russia. And, you know, most of Europe, I think all of Europe, condemned Russia's invasion, basically, of Ukraine and Crimea. But Europe engaged in sanctions on Nord Stream. Angela Merkel was very unpopular for still wanting the oil to flow to Germany. It's not supposed to flow anywhere else. My conclusion just reading this is we are trying to offer a carrot to Russia in order to perhaps get cooperation in certain areas. Russia's working with us on a new agreement for Iran. So all I'm saying is there are some interesting outreach by the Biden administration. And finally, they've come up with an interim national security strategy. which is the first strategy I've seen over four presidencies. I make the point in my book that when the Cold War ended, we didn't have a strategy. We thought we won, they lost, everybody wants to be us, game over. Well, oops, it didn't turn out like that.
Well, thank you. And thank you, Jane. It's a wonderful book. I can't recommend it more highly. Anyone interested, either in politics or policy in the United States, ought to read it. The title of the book is Insanity Defense. It was great seeing you, Jane. Thanks for spending some time with me.
Well, Janet, it's a long friendship. And remember, if you want a friend, get a girlfriend. And I value this friendship. And I thought your questions are exciting. We could go on for hours. And let's just make our country better. That would be my last line.
You got that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to C-SPAN's Afterwards podcast. You might be interested in C-SPAN's newest podcast, Book Notes Plus. Brian Lamb has wide-ranging conversations with authors and historians. The 30-minute podcast is available every Tuesday. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.